Okay, welcome back to the Feeble Minded Podcast. Today I'm joined by the founding father of long distance pushing, Jack Smith. How's it going?
Good, and you?
Doing good. Thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
It's cool, man. I don't get the opportunity to talk to many people that have done, you know, the skate across America. So I'm excited to pick your brain.
It's a pretty exclusive club, and you belong to a really exclusive club because you did it solo.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to talk about it. So just a quick breakdown for everyone who's unfamiliar. You've crossed the country 5 times or now 6?
4 times pushing and 1 time on an electric board.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So 5 times, and first time was back in 1976.
Yes, when I was 19 years old.
Yep. And then you also have the Guinness World Record for the first person to cross an electric skateboard, right?
Yeah. I never submitted it to Guinness because, as you know, it's a lot of paperwork. And
yeah,
you know, I was just doing it to do it because I'd always wanted to push across solo, but never had the time or the opportunity to. And the electric skateboard, especially at 61 years of age, afforded me that opportunity.
Yeah. Hey, Guinness or not, still,
yeah,
that's an incredible achievement. Yeah. And that's just, you know, an arbitrary label from essentially a company. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you know, you're doing it first or you're doing it for your own, you know, so that's incredible.
Yeah. Well, I was, you know, watching your podcast the other night, one of your podcasts, and you were talking about, you know, all the stuff you had to do for Guinness and you know, mind boggling.
But I didn't even include most of the tedious things every day. Like it was a lot. And even beforehand, what people didn't see was like emailing takes 2 weeks to hear back from them over and over and over. And like, it was, you know, definitely made it a little more annoying.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, I mean, you know, as I watched your trip and, you know, we chatted while you were on your trip, that you were able to skate, then do these great videos and then have to deal with it was amazing.
It was tough, but sometimes I feel like I do my best when I'm like fully locked in and have all these challenges.
Yeah.
I can't even have the time to think of anything else.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. But so I want to ask you about that first trip back in 76.
Right.
So did you skate, like do tricks and stuff like that before that? Or what was your history in skateboarding leading up to that?
Yeah. You know, as a kid, a young kid, I was 8 years old in 1964. During the first wave of, you know, steel wheels and clay wheels. And my dad made me a board along with all the other neighborhood kids. And, you know, I think I rode the thing 2 weeks. And even as an 8-year-old kid, I figured out this isn't that much fun. And then forgot about skateboarding until the summer of 74, when I graduated from high school. I was at a friend's house and we found an old Hobie skateboard that was in his backyard. You know, I was in his backyard every day. I had never seen the board. And one day we saw it and we started riding and it still had the clay wheels. And we would only skate at night on the sidewalks of our local town because at that point, skateboarding was still considered a little kid's thing. And, you know, we didn't want to be, you know, considered little kids.
Interesting.
And then we heard about urethane wheels and traveled 150 miles, drove 150 miles one day to buy urethane wheels because that was the closest place we could get them. And from that day on, I was hooked and, you know, started off, you know, just doing slalom stuff, skating down sidewalks, freestyle, skated. And then we, you know, found ditches, started skating ditches. And then kind of my real introduction to like competitive skateboarding was, I don't know if you've seen the movie Lords of Dogtown or Dogtown and Z-Boys, either one. So,
of course,
there was a big contest, the Bain Cadillac Nationals, which was the first big contest of the 70s. And I went down and entered that and, you know, did okay, made the finals. I think I finished like in 18th place or something. But kind of a neat story behind that is it was the first time that my dad recognized what I was doing. Before that, it was always like, no, you're too old to be skateboarding. I was 17, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember calling him up from a payphone and saying, Dad, I made the finals. And he was stoked. So I just took off from there. And then it was funny, you know, 30 years later in 2005, I played the role of the announcer at that contest, the Ben Cadillac that was in the movie Lords of Dogtown. So it was like walking back in time 30 years.
Yeah, full circle too.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Skateboarding brought you right back. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so awesome. So what was the difference in the clay wheels? Because I'd never rode those. So like, what was the jump in going the urethane? Like, what did that feel like? And what did clay feel like to ride on?
Yeah. Clay, you know, I used to tell people that, you know, the only time the clay wheels just were a really rough ride. You couldn't really ride asphalt that well. You could ride smooth cement. So we did a lot of skating on clay wheels on sidewalks or at schoolyards or in the hallways of schools because they just didn't work on rough stuff. And when we rode urethane for the first time, you know, it's like going from, you know, Volkswagen to Ferrari, you know, it was that much of a difference. We couldn't believe it. And that was urethane wheels with loose ball bearing. And then eventually, you know, a year later or so, Road Rider came out with, you know, precision bearing wheel. And then that was a whole nother step up and to how good. Yeah, it was mind boggling. And if you ever come to California,
it must have, like, blew your whole world. Like, you know,
it's all
such
I wanted,
a big change.
It's all I wanted to do. You know, once we got on urethane, it's like every day. That's all I wanted to do. So
that's
funny. If you ever come to California, I'll get you on a clay wheel board.
Oh, I got to try it one day. So I'm guessing that's what led to the psych. So then after this comes out, you're just getting more and more into it. And what led to the Skate Across America idea?
Well, it really came down to the town I live in, Morro Bay, and I have lived there for 50 years now. It's a town of about 10,000 people. There's not a lot of job opportunities for, you know, teenagers, especially back then. You worked in a restaurant, you know, maybe worked on a fishing boat, worked in a grocery store. And none of us, you know, we're thinking, what could we do in the summer to get away from having one of those jobs? And to this day, I don't know when one of us was, where we were sitting around a table one night in the spring of 76 and like, what can we do? And somebody threw out the idea, hey, let's skateboard across America. And we all thought it sounded great. So we wrote a letter to one company, a company that had sent me some wheels for that contest down in San Diego at the Bain Cadillac, told them what we're up to, what we wanted to do. And, you know, we thought, we'll never hear anything. 2 weeks later, we got a letter back. And they made us an offer. They said, we'll give you, and we thought it was going to take us 60 days. So they said, we'll give you all the gear you need, boards, wheels, trucks. And we'll give each of you a t-shirt for each day of the trip. So 180 t-shirts. So, and it said, and then at the end of the trip, if you make it, we'll pay you guys $500 each. And we're like, oh yeah, let's go. And, so, you know, they sent us the gear. Only one of us had a car as the support vehicle that could make it. It was my buddy's Jeff's 69 Firebird. And actually the two guys that were going to go with me originally bailed out at the last minute. One of them did. Jeff and I, we needed one more guy. And so I went down to our local ditch one day and saw a guy, you know, I didn't really know him, just through skating at the ditch, and said, hey, you want to go? And he's a guy named Mike Philbin signed up with us. And, you know, we didn't train for this thing at all. You know, we just figured out a route. We built a rack for the top of the car. One of the funny things is we actually took a gun with us. We had a .22 rifle in the trunk. You know, we didn't really know why, but it sounded like a good idea at the time in case we ended up in some weird space. And then we figured out the route, and our thinking was, let's do it across the northern part of the country. For two reasons. One, we thought it might be a little cooler in the summertime. Well, that didn't work out. It was still plenty hot. And then the other reason was we thought less populated, maybe less traffic. And that kind of worked out. So off we went to Oregon.
So. From my experience and my research and everything, the north definitely makes a little more sense. The trip, I think, is shorter too. And less mountains and a little more flat.
Yeah, especially, you know, I mean, we were kind of thrown into the fire because, like, the first day, We started in Lebanon, Oregon. We didn't start right on the coast. It's about, I don't know, 40 or 50 miles from the coast. And the only reason we started there was because these people at a foster home said, "Hey, you can stay with us tonight." So we took them up on their offer. Right. And so we started in Lebanon. But, you know, the very first day we were into the Cascades, into the mountains. And I mean, really the first week we didn't know if we could make it. You know, you probably messed up some of that.
That first week, 2 week period is for me, that was like the whole thing where I knew if I could do it or not. You know, once you make it past that, you're kind of like locked in.
Yep.
Your body gets used to it. But before that, you're like, I don't know.
One thing, you know, I just want to make sure that, you know, that your viewers and listeners realize is that you did it solo. We did it as a relay, and the way our relay worked, we called it, and it came up with this name, we call it a leapfrog relay. So one guy starts skating. The car would drive out 3 miles in front and park. The second skater would get out and take off. The car would wait for the first guy. When he got there, they would drive 3 miles ahead from that point, passing the second skater, stop. The third guy would get out and start skating. The car would wait for the second guy to get to the car. So we would do, you know, 35 to 50 miles a day individually. So we could cover 100 to 150 on a good day. Each of us ended up skating about a little under 1,000 miles each for the trip.
Which is a lot. Yeah. When I was doing the research, I saw that like each guy skated 30 miles. So I thought it was like one guy skated 30, right, then you switched. But I didn't realize it was every three. That's a lot. That makes more sense.
And you can keep a faster pace. And then, you know, when we got into the mountains, going up some steep mountains, you know, we would cut that down sometimes to a half mile so you could keep a faster turnover.
So, yeah. Now it gets brutal when you're going uphill.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's people are locked into like riding, you know, when they drive across country in a car, just drive around in a car, you know, you don't really pay attention to the road. You know, you don't pay attention to the surface that much, you know, and I always joke with the guys that I've skated with on the different trips, like for the rest of your life, you're going to notice shoulders of roads when you're driving. My wife does now. You know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It completely changes your perspective. Like you're not really honed in on the asphalt or like, the shoulder.
Yeah.
That's so funny. I'm guessing there was no, you know, internet really at the time at all. How'd you come up with the route? You had to literally write it like on a map.
I'd read an article someplace, because it was 1976, it was the bicentennial of America, and I'd read about a bike path, or not a path, but a bike route called the bike centennial route that went across America. So I wrote off and I got their map. And it started where we wanted and it ended where we wanted, but it kind of meandered around a lot. And so we kind of just modified that. We had a road atlas, you know, and we just looked for secondary highways. And then once we were on the secondary highways, if we found like a county road, we would switch to that just to stay away from traffic. But yeah, it was all paper. And you know, it's funny how you bring up the internet is that now like almost every year, I'll get emails from people who are thinking about skating cross country, you know, can you give me some advice? And then I see them posted online too. And in some of the groups, you know, the people in the group are like, well, what about this? What about that? You know, I don't think you should do it. And I tell people, I'm kind of glad the internet wasn't around in 76, because I don't know if we would have done it, because there would have been so much, you can't get up the mountains. You can't do this.
Yeah.
We were just ignorant. We just did it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of the best way to do things in my perspective. Like I even called you. Yeah. I don't know if you remember this, called you beforehand and picked your brain. And I was like, you were the only person to look to really for a template or like just learn anything about it really, you know, it's nothing else. So, but yeah, I was like, just jumping into it, you figure it out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? All the noise and all the talking and everything, it just kind of disappears and you're there in the moment and you figure it out. But with the internet, you kind of, maybe you'll get scared of something
But, go ahead.
So what was the, Like, would you stop and hang out with people as you were going, or did you try to stay pretty much focused the whole time?
No, we would stop. I mean, usually, you know, we'd get people to stop us, you know, alongside the road, because in 76, once you got out of California or the East Coast, even where skateboarding was happening, you know, people hadn't seen a skateboard in 10 years from back in the 60s. And they're like, what the hell are you guys doing? So we had a lot of encounters like that. We ran into a lot of people that, you know, hey, you want to stay at our house tonight? So we, you know, we'd camp with them. Most of the time we camped. A couple of times we got free motels, because we got ready to do the trip. The our local chamber of commerce, a buddy of mine ran it, and he had his secretary write letters to other chambers of commerce along our route. And so sometimes we'd get a free motel here and there, but mainly we camped. Wow. We'd meet people in restaurants at campgrounds. So yeah,
that was really cool. Yeah, and everything was done through mail. Surprised you can have that reach, get sponsors and stuff like through. Yeah, you know, just
we were really lucky. You know, players. Yeah, really lucky. You know, especially with the board company, they're the company. Roller Sports was the company, and they were one of the big companies at the time.
Yeah,
they made
$500 back then. Probably went a little further than today, and you were probably stoked when you heard that.
Yeah, and so it was $500 if we finished. I think we all kicked in about $200 to start, but you know, I think the summer gas prices were, you know, it was 49 cents a gallon or something, and you know, we weren't extravagant at all, and we made it to Minneapolis, and we were almost out of money. So we called Roller Sports and said, hey, you know, it looks like we're going to make it, but we're getting pretty low on money. And so the company wired us $500. So they actually wired it to one of their dealers in Minneapolis. And then we went to that shop, and the guy gave us $500 in cash so we could finish the trip.
Wow.
Or we wouldn't have been able to finish it with money.
So, that's funny. Wow.
I've actually got here, if you want to see it, a board just like the one I rode across in 76.
Yeah, I'd love to see it. Yeah.
It's the closest one to what you did your trip on. So it's
unreal.
It's electric.
Yeah, just, I can't imagine that small surface area for the whole trip.
25 inches long. It's made out of a material called Lexan. It was actually made by General Electric. And then, you know, these are Stoker wheels, and we thought they were huge. They were 57 millimeter.
That's so funny.
Very stiff board, but yeah, this is a replica.
So yeah, that was one thing I wanted to ask you was, I saw the board, like pictures of it, you know, when I was doing my research, but did those wheels hold the whole time? Were they harder? Did they break? Tell me about those.
You know, I have no idea what the, you know, durometer was. I'm guessing it was probably 90, 88 to not, man, it had to be 90. Okay. And we had a ton of wheels. We had, I don't know, we had 100 sets of wheels.
Okay.
And they didn't really wear out. But the one thing we noticed was the constant, you know, they'd be on the hot surface when you're riding, you know, and then they would cool off, and that combination of heating and cooling stole whatever resilience they had. So we changed wheels quite often because we had them, you know, might as well have a fresh set on. but they're nothing like modern urethane. I mean, I know the wheels you rode, the Seismics, I mean, fantastic wheel. And then the wheels I rode later, you know, each progression of when we did it, huge change in equipment. Because I mean,
I saw the later rides you did.
Yeah.
The much bigger wheels, drop down board, like those things make such a difference. And I knew that going into mine, you know, like I knew the drop down board would significantly help me.
Right.
The bigger wheels. But, you know, I skated, done tricks my whole life. So I just wanted to keep the continuity, you know?
And I, you know, it was funny. I actually, you know, I still go to some of the long distance forums, and a couple of times I just, you know, kind of went off on some people that were giving you crap about, well, he should be on a drop down, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, man, this is what he wants to do.
Yeah, it's exactly what you're used to.
It's what you're used to. And I thought it was very cool to get it on a regular board, you know?
Yeah.
So, the change was, the next trip we did was in 1984. And it was with two of my buddies, who were a few years younger than me, And they'd kind of just gotten tired of hearing all the stories, you know, about my trip in 76. One day we were skating Highway 1 between Big Sur and Morro Bay because it was closed and it had brand new pavement. So we snuck onto it and we skated 58 miles in a day.
Wow.
And on that trip, we decided, let's do it again. And so we started putting the trip together. We decided we wanted to do it for a charity or for a cause. And we did it for Multiple Sclerosis Society. And then we invited a fourth guy to join the team, a guy named Bob DeNike, who great skater, probably the best skater of any of us. And he
and
went
what year
on,
was this?
This was 84.
Okay.
And he went on to fame and fortune. He ended up being the president of Santa Cruz Skateboards later on, NHS.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. So, but a great skater, great downhill skater, great street skater, ramp skater, everything. But so we put together a package, a sponsorship package, and sent it to people in the industry. But we needed, none of us had a great car for a support vehicle. So we actually wrote a letter to the Chrysler Corporation and told them what we were going to do. And, you know, really, Paul, my buddy Paul Dunn wrote the letter, and it was really flowery and, you know, blew a lot of smoke. And they called us up and said, tell us a little bit more about your trip, what you're doing. And we told them, okay, we'll let you borrow a van for the summer, but you got to come to Detroit and pick it up. So my dad and I and Paul flew to Detroit, picked up this van, drove it home. And the interesting thing about it, Chad, was they took us, well, when we got there, we went into the world headquarters of Chrysler. And, you know, we met the guys and said, okay, let's go out and pick out your van. But before you do, the guy said, can any of you guys do a handstand on your board? And I said, yeah, I can do a handstand. Why? He says, well, we want to take some pictures of you doing one. So I did a handstand down the hallway of the Walter P. Chrysler World Headquarters building. And it was weird because people were looking out their cubicles like, what the hell? You know, kind of skateboard. So they take us out to the place to get the van. And they said, well, go out and see which one you want. So, you know, being in our 20s, we found the one with the best stereo and picked it out and took it over. They filled it up with gas. They slapped a couple decals on the side and said, all right, when will you bring it back? I don't know, August? All right. We didn't sign anything. It was, that's how loose it was back then. It's like,
wow,
okay.
Yeah.
They said, call us once in a while. And actually, when we got done with the trip, they offered to sell us the van for a really good price, but you know, none of us wanted a van. But
yeah,
so we had good sponsorship that time. Wow. We had Madrid gave us boards, decks to use. Indy, Tracker, and Gullwing all gave us trucks, Kryptonics wheels, and so.
From what I found, it was kind of difficult to get sponsors that would actually give money and help fund
mm-hmm.
project. That's because anyone will give their product because it's like, you know, a couple bucks and they get this exposure.
Exactly.
But when it comes to actually fronting the money to help make it happen, it's actually pretty hard.
Yeah. In 84, our sponsorship package, to be an official sponsor, you had to give us gear and you had to help out with expenses. And Madrid gave us gear and $750. Kryptonics gave us wheels and $500. Independent gave us trucks and then an extra case of trucks we sold to a shop to get some money.
That's awesome.
Here's the board that I rode in 84. So, you know, Madrid longboard, pretty long, 40 inches, you know, wider trucks.
Yeah.
And big wheels, 70 millimeter wheels. I mean, and Kryptonics, when they came out with the Kryptonics Reds, the 70 millimeters, it was another game changer in the history of skateboarding because they had resilience. And I think we only...
What do you mean by resilience? Exactly.
Rebound.
Okay.
Like the Super Bowl effect, you know?
Right.
Where the first generation of urethane wheels had hardly any rebound. So the more rebound you have...
So on asphalt and things like that, it's not, you know, as smooth.
Yeah. So... huge game changer. We had, each of us had a long board in them, and then they even made us a shorter board that was only 5-ply that was super light that sometimes we used when we were skating up hills. So,
okay.
And that trip took that trip, we started in Newport, Oregon, right on the coast. And we finished again in Williamsburg, Virginia, which isn't, it's not really on the coast, but there's the Chesapeake Bay comes in there. So we figured that was close enough.
Yeah.
And there was four guys on that team. The first trip in 76 took us 32 days. But this trip with better equipment and four guys, we were able to cut 6 days off and do it in 26 days.
So funny story about that is when I'm first researching all this, I know nothing about it. I've only skated, done tricks, you know, never pushed more than a couple of miles. And I see the world record, 26 days. And I'm like, I got to beat 26 days. Like, how am I going to do it? I started doing math. And I was like, I have to do 105 miles every day. And in my head before I did it, I was determined to try to beat that, not knowing how hard that is, and especially on like a shortboard.
Sure.
But, you know, the more I like studied and learned.
Relay, yeah.
It's still like, you know, it's 26 days is, it's still a lot of miles, you know?
Yeah.
Even if you're breaking it up with people, it's tough on the body and mind.
Yeah, and you know what? And I'll tell you, and I tell this to people all the time, you know, each of those trips that we did it with a support vehicle, there were places where, you know, if it was like just super dangerous, you know, we would find a different road. So unlike you, you know, who skated every inch, there were places where we didn't skate, you know, and I don't know what that mileage added up to, probably less than 50 miles or something. But, you know, to see somebody do it, you know, solo every inch is, that's why I was so into following you, man, because I knew what it was like, you know, to be out there.
Yeah, it's a different thing. It's hard to really picture, but not having that comfort of I can get in the car if someone comes up to me with a gun, or if someone does this or that, or if it rains or whatever it is, you have something. You could rest for a second, hide from the sun. Like, there's just, it helps.
Yeah. Well, my wife and I were watching your podcast the other night, and you were talking about how you had just maybe a couple weird encounters on your trip. And in 76, the only weird encounter we had was this guy in a, it's like a Coca-Cola delivery truck. He would we didn't know he was back there, because he would turn his motor off and he would coast up right behind you. And then when he turned his motor back on, it would backfire. So you thought you were getting shot or something. And, you know, it made one of our guys crash, but you know, that trip, we really didn't have any weird encounters. In 84, kind of funny, we got kicked off the road in Wisconsin by this, you know, sheriff guy. And so all we did was drive up out of his county and find another east-west road. But then it was funny, in 2003, we're skating in Wisconsin. Or no, in 76, we got kicked off the road by this guy in Wisconsin, the sheriff. 84, we're in the same county, the same cop kicks us off the road again.
No,
yeah,
really?
Because like, when the guy got pulled over in 84, the first thing the sheriff said to him was like, hey, there were some guys, you know, 10 years ago came through here and I kicked them off my road. You can't be on my road, you know?
Wow, cool.
So,
I've learned too from my trip that a lot of these places, they don't really know, no one really knows the law. And they're just kind of making it up to like whatever they feel like doing that day, you know?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And that happened on pretty much every trip. The craziest thing that has happened to us on all of the trips combined was in 84. We had just come out of Yellowstone Park. You're not allowed to skate in Yellowstone.
Okay.
So we just come out of the eastern side of Yellowstone, heading towards Cody, Wyoming. And three of us were in the van, and we were driving to catch up with the guy in front of us to drop off the next guy. And we come to this bridge, and this is out in the middle of nowhere. And all of a sudden, a woman comes running up onto the highway, and she's just totally, you know, distraught. And so, you know, she stands in the middle of the road waving her arms for us to stop. And she's, so we stop, we jump out, like, what's going on? She goes, I think my baby just drowned in the river. I'm like, oh my God. And so about that time, this cowboy guy comes walking up out of the river with a little 2-year-old girl in his arms. She's blue. I mean, she looks dead. And she says, are you guys, she was so freaked out. She thought we were the ambulance because we were a van. So we said, get in the van, you know, we'll take you to Cody, to the hospital. And so the cowboy guy, the little girl, they jump in, the mom jumps in, and Paul takes off towards Cody, Wyoming. And about 5 miles down the road, Paul sees a sheriff car just driving along the other way. So he pulls in front. He blocks the lane of the sheriff's car to make him stop.
Wow.
Paul, he figured he could get the little girl to the hospital quicker.
Yeah.
They get the little girl out of the car and are taking her towards the sheriff's car, and she stopped breathing. So they're doing CPR on the side of the road. About that time, a doctor on his way to Yellowstone on vacation comes rolling up, sees what's happening. He gets out. He takes over. They get the little girl in the sheriff's car. Off they go to Cody. So Paul turns around, drives back to us, and, you know, we're kind of freaked out, but we still got 40 miles to skate. So eventually we make it down to Cody, and after dinner, we went to the hospital. And as we got to the hospital, the mom is coming out, and she's like, oh, you guys, thank you so much, you know, for your help. And we're like, well, what's going on with your baby? And she says, we don't know. They just put her on a life flight helicopter to Salt Lake City. So that's 1984. We had no idea whatever happened. Until 2011, Gary Fluitt, one of the guys on that trip, is getting ready to move back to California from Colorado. And he finds a newspaper article. And he worked for Google, so he knew how to search stuff. He found a newspaper article that he had about the trip. And it mentioned the girl's last name, the family's last name. So, and that they were from Utah. So he starts snooping around online, and he finds a woman who would be about the right age, in her late 20s, with the same last name. He finds her email address. He sends her an email and says, hey, you know, I don't know if you're the little girl, but, you know, we were these guys skating across country, and we were involved in what we hope was a successful rescue, but we don't know. Just wondering if you're that little girl. So months go by, Gary doesn't hear anything. Finally, he gets an email back, and it's from this person. And she says, it's so weird, Gary, that I got your email today, because I don't use this email address anymore. In fact, the only reason I came on today online was to close this account. And she says, I am the little girl that you guys helped rescue. No. Thank you for helping save my life.
Wow.
And so Gary sends me the email, and she said, you know, no after effects. She was fine. She became a newspaper reporter, a writer. She was getting ready to publish her first novel. Gary sends me the email. And so I'm reading at my desk that night, and I read through it, and I'm like blown away. And then I turned to my wife and I tried to read it to her, and I got like two sentences in and I just lost it.
Yeah.
And what was interesting about that day was we usually started skating like at 7:30 in the morning. Well, that day it was raining. So we had to wait for, you know, till 9 o'clock or something to start skating till the roads dried off. Then we got to Yellowstone, and we knew we couldn't skate in Yellowstone, but we tried anyway. And we got a few miles in, we got busted. So we're like, what the hell? Let's go over and look at it, watch Old Faithful, you know, do its thing. So we get there, it just went off. So we walk around because it goes off like every hour. We come back, we missed it again. So then we just sat there for an hour and waited for it to go off. And then, you know, we went on our way. So if all those things hadn't lined up that day to put us there at that exact time, who knows?
Yeah.
So that's
an unbelievable story.
Yeah.
And it's cool that you got the resolution later, exactly. You know?
Yeah.
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 So, wow. That's incredible. So I was going to ask if you had any near-death experiences skating on the trip.
No.
No, nothing with traffic or anything like that?
Not me personally. Bob was skating one time on the 84 trip. We're between Boise, Idaho, and Mountain Home, Idaho. And there's really not a frontage road, so we were allowed to skate on the side of the freeway. And so Bob was out in front of us skating about a mile out in front. And two of us were in the van waiting for the guy behind us to catch up. And when he got in, we had noticed this truck go by us, this big lumber truck, and we didn't really notice right away, but the load had shifted, and there was this like big beam, like, I don't know, 4x4, 6x6 beam sticking out at head height. And we see that if Bob doesn't turn around and see it, it's going to decapitate him because this truck's going 60 miles an hour. And we're, you know, we're honking, we're screaming, but there's no way he can hear us. And for some reason, maybe like, you know, a few hundred feet before the truck got to him, he just happened to turn around and, you know, oh, there's a truck coming with a board sticking out. So he just picked up his board and stepped off the road. If he wouldn't have turned around, probably would have died.
You know? Yeah. It's so weird how just those little moments, like one little thing can change the entire trajectory of someone's life, or, you know, and I've had those too, where I'm out there and like one step sideways and things could have turned out completely differently. You know,
I was listening to your podcast and you talked about that time when you just happened to kind of wobble on your board and you said you stepped and there was a car that went by.
Yeah. I could feel like brush on me. Yeah.
and a huge difference between what you did and what we did as a relay is, you know, we were only skating 3 miles at a time. So we could be hyper vigilant for those 3 miles. And I found how much harder it is when I did the electric board trip, because I was on the road like you were for a lot of hours a day. And just to maintain that focus on like what's behind you. I mean, I got to the point where I could almost tell just by the sound of something coming up behind me, if something was a little fishy, you probably did too.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, it becomes like second nature. You could, you know, you're a little more sensitive to everything. And you have to be so attentive every second of the day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it's so you've got the physical part and then you got the mental part and you're just exhausted. I think the mental part was more exhausting on the electric board trip for me because I wasn't pushing.
Yeah.
But still I had the mental side of, you know, am I going to get run over from behind? In fact, I don't know if you know, but I did the electric board trip in two parts. I started and did the first part of it 2016, started in Eugene, Oregon, and I made it to Mountain Home, Idaho. But in that 500 miles, I had two, what I think were very close calls with semi trucks. And so I got to Mountain Home and the next morning I got up and we went out to where we'd left off and I put my board down and I didn't get on it. I chickened out. I was scared. So I told my buddy, I'm done. So we went home and I thought that's it, you know.
I thought that was just you and your wife on that trip
that was the second part of the trip. So the first part is me and my buddy Ed, who was my support driver. So I went home. And for the next 2 years, it bugged the crap out of me that I quit. And I tell people, you know, I kept hearing my dad's voice. And believe it or not, my high school woodshop teacher, a guy named Mr. Gerard, in my head saying, you know, finish what you start.
That's awesome.
So 2018, my wife retired. Two of our kids got married that summer. And then I said, I want to do it again. My wife said, all right, let's go. And luckily found a sponsor. And a company let us also borrow a cool Volkswagen van to be the support vehicle. And so my wife and I drove up to Mountain Home, Idaho, and started where we left off, where I quit. And 45 days later, we were in Washington, D.C.
Wow. So I've ridden an electric skateboard. Like briefly, not that long, but your legs start to hurt as you're standing on there because you're not moving them. So like almost pushing kind of helps in a sense.
You're so right. You know, a lot of people like, oh, you're cheating. And it's like, well, I'm not pushing, but your legs do get almost crampy.
Yeah, very quickly.
And so I did everything I could to alleviate some of that. I put padding underneath my grip tape. I wore shoes that had, you know, this much sole on them. I put big soft wheels in the front. I couldn't put big soft wheels in the back due to the nature of the board. But what I would do is, you know, every 2 or 3 miles, I would get off and walk around because I knew if I had to bail, my feet weren't going to work. and I was going to, you know, go down. And I think on the electric board trip, very rarely did I go more than like 12 or 13 miles an hour. Cause I knew at that speed, I could probably get a couple steps in and roll it off. If I was going faster and I fell, I wasn't going to get back up.
That's the thing about electric skateboard too, is I've cruised on them, you know, around New York and stuff. And you're going 20 miles an hour, 30 miles an hour, and one little mistake, one misstep, one lean the wrong way, just a hair can hit you, like, you know, be fatal, really.
Exactly. And so many people that start riding electric skateboards, a lot of them have never skated. And even some of those guys who have skated on, you know, trick boards is what I call them, aren't used to speed. They have no idea. Like, okay, when you're going 20, you can't just run it off, you know?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, so.
Or a little, press on your toe, just like a hair at 20 is a much different than when you go on 5.
Yeah. You know? So, I mean, I still ride my electric board, but, you know, I was very, very careful when I did the trip. But
So how old were you when you did that trip or when you finished it?
An electric board trip, I was 61 when I finished. So
that's incredible. And did you have, and this goes for any of the trips, did you have people telling you to not do this, like in the 76 trip, at the 60?
So 76, you know, when I told my parents about it, that I wanted to do this and we'd gotten a sponsor, my dad was just adamant. No, no, you can't do that. And I'm like, you know, I don't really need your permission. You know, I'm 18. He's like, well, you're living under my roof. You know, you do what I say. And so it was, I mean, it was really heated. And then it was really weird. One day, my dad came home from work and he had just had an epiphany or something. And he came to me and said, you know, I've been thinking if I was a young guy and I had this opportunity, I'd want to do it. So go ahead. You know, so that made it a lot better.
So he came around.
Yeah, that's huge. Came around and became a huge supporter the rest of my life as far as, you know, skateboarding. Yeah, every trip, you know.
That's awesome. That doesn't happen too often usually. No. Like, you know, yeah.
No, I was very lucky. And every trip we had naysayers, but as the more I did it, the more people, the fewer I had, you know, because, oh, you've done this before. You know, and between, you know, after the 84 trip, we didn't do another trip until 2003, 19 years. And what brought that crossing on was I had a son who was born, Jack Marshall Smith. He was born born in 1988. And he was born with a very rare genetic syndrome called Lowe's syndrome. At the time, there were only like 350 boys, because it only affects boys in the world that had this thing. And it's genetic based, and it's a, what they call a renal based syndrome. What happens is when the baby's in the womb, the kidneys can't differentiate what to keep and what to pass on, and so it creates problems with their development. All the boys that are born with it, 100% have cataracts. 50% have glaucoma. He had both. Anywhere from mild to severe mental retardation, small stature, low muscle tone, and eventually develop seizures, and then eventually the kidneys will fail. And when Jack was born, I remember they sat us down in this little room, my wife and I, and said, well, he probably won't live past 2, because there just wasn't much information at the time. Well, he ended up living to be 14, and he died in 2003. And he had, for the most part of his life, pretty good quality of life, except for the last few years. And then the seizures got really bad. So he passed away in 2003. And that's when I decided, you know, I want to do another crossing and raise not only money, but awareness of this thing. I thought, you know, if one other family could, you know, hear about this and their son's born with cataracts, know to have him checked out for possible Lowe's syndrome.
Yeah.
So we did that trip in 2003, and that was an amazing, it was the first trip we were able to use the internet to help with sponsorship.
Mm-hmm.
And so we threw it out there and got great support from people who donated to Low Syndrome. I think we raised between $25,000, $30,000, something like that.
Wow.
And then the industry as a whole got behind us. We had great sponsorship from the industry. And like we did in 84, you had to give us gear and then you had to give us some money to help with our expenses. And the best one was, there's a company called Harbinger and they make pads, skate pads and stuff. And we didn't even send a letter to these guys, an email. Somehow they just heard about it. And this guy calls me up one evening and says, "Hey, we got your email. We want to help out." Says here in your email that you guys need gear, you know, plus $1,000 to be an official sponsor. I said, "Yeah, that's what we're asking for." And he's like, "Okay, here's what we'll do. Here's what we can do. We'll give you guys all the gear you need." And so I'm waiting for the shoe to drop for him to say, "But we can't give you any money."
Yeah.
And he says, "So, and it's $1,000, right, for official sponsorship?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to give each of you guys $1,000. So $4,000 in expense money."
Wow.
So that put us over the top. So we were able to, you know, do the trip. We had plenty of money to make the trip and had a lot of money left over. So
that's incredible.
That was 2003. And I'll let me grab the board here that we did that win.
Okay. So much, much different than the previous setups. Wow. Yeah. Those wheels and the drop down, it's like, it's a game changer.
Oh, it was, we couldn't believe how, and that board is actually made, it's a Rolls-Royce. It was made in Germany they were still made in Germany and they gave us, you know, the decks. We had to do the setup ourselves, but drop down, really big wheels. Those are like 95 millimeter wheels or something.
Yeah.
Boards are kind of stiff, but because we're only doing 3 or 5 to 5 miles at a time, you know, didn't matter that much, but the drop down thing. Oh my God.
Yeah. Oh yeah, game changer. And that, a lot of people asked why I didn't use like bigger wheels or, you know, higher trucks so I wouldn't get wheel bite. And the main reason was because I wanted to stay lower to the ground. So like the best wheels I could do, but while still staying close to the ground, because that bending of the quad just wears on you over time.
That's what I always tell people. It's not your push leg. It's the leg on the board going up and down. So if you can minimize that motion, you don't get tired as quick. How big were the wheels you used? Like 68?
So, 68 millimeter.
68 millimeter, yeah. And every time I look at that, when I kept looking at pictures of your board when you were done, you know, and looking at those wheels, freaking. And I think I even told you one time when we were talking, "Chad, you need another set of wheels. I can get Dan to send you a set." And you're like, "No, I'm good."
You would laugh if you saw my inbox on Instagram and YouTube. Oh, it was unbelievable the amount of people telling me to change my wheels. It was funny.
Yeah.
But it's kind of that same determination like that you had when your dad was saying no. It's like you almost kind of need that, like, no matter what, I have this vision, I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. That kind of resolve is what like helps you basically be able to do things like this, you know?
So I've got a question for you. Was there a point where you wanted to quit?
So the only time something like that came up was, I think it was the first day it rained. It was day 30, 31.
Okay.
All day I was in Texas and it was chip seal. First time I really like ran into like the thick of it.
We talked about that.
Yeah. It was so bad. Every single road all day long. I'm pushing as I'm going downhill.
Yep.
It's just, you know, and yeah, it's raining. I'm not moving. Like I'm pushing as hard as I can and I'm not moving an inch.
Yep.
So you do that for an hour straight and you just like stand on the side of the road and you're just like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. I would just exhale and be like, I would just stop for a second and just stare and be like, how am I going to finish this day? But then what else are you going to do? You know, you got to make it to the hotel. So you just, all right. But that type of experience, like, It's like, okay, what am I going to do next? I got to move forward. You know, yep. It's just the end of the day. Just keep moving.
Chip seal is just hell. I remember doing the same thing as you. We were on a 6% downgrade in Oregon, and we were pushing. And we were on big wheels. I mean, huge wheels. And I was used to tell people that, like, the whole state of Idaho was chip seal. One time we were skating, we actually caught up to the chip seal machine and had to pass it. You know? And to me, it's like, why are you ruining a perfectly good road? You know?
Yeah, you're ruining it. Yeah, that's the whole time. You have plenty of time to think while you're out there. So you're looking down at the ground and you see smooth ground under it. And you're like, why did they do this?
Yeah. You know, on that 2003 ride, we had a guy on the trip, a guy named Josh Moretti. I'd never met the guy until the day before we left on the trip. Somebody recommended him. We needed one more guy. Somebody recommended him. I talked to him on the phone. He came, he met us in Oregon. And the more I think about it, he reminds me a lot of you. And how, if you had been on one of our trips, how you would have been. Because Josh was 24 at the time, street skater, had never even been on a longboard until the day he started skating cross country with us on a Rolls Royce of all things, the lowered board.
Yeah.
And it was he was the guy that helped, even though he was 20 years younger than the rest of the guys, he had an attitude very much like yours, very low key, just keep going. And he's really the glue that held that trip together. I think if he wouldn't have been on that trip, we would have imploded. So
I think when I was a kid, I remember seeing clips of him in skate videos. I'm pretty sure I've heard of him. Yeah. He's been in videos, I believe.
Yeah. He was originally from North Carolina, but he now lives in New York City, and he's a big time fashion and product photographer in New York City, but still skates.
Yeah. So. Wow. That's funny. So what was the, of all the trips, which one probably got the most attention? What happened in 76 when you finished? Was anyone there? Was it
No, we actually, like I told you, the Chamber of Commerce helped us out on that trip, our local Chamber of Commerce, and they had gotten in touch with the Williamsburg Chamber of Commerce. And so we stopped just on the edge of town so that all three of us could skate together to finish. And we had heard that there was going to be somebody to meet us there at the finish line in Merchant Square. So we come skating up and there's a freaking crowd of people, you know, not like you had, but there's a crowd of people. And so we come skating up and it was the Chamber of Commerce guy there. I think maybe the mayor. And they, you know, welcomed us. This one of the sponsors from the guy, one of the vice presidents of Roller Sports came up to give us our money, gave us cash. It was great.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
And, was there news there at all?
Yeah, there was. Yeah, there's a couple newspapers there, and there's some. And I still have some of the articles from that. But yeah, we were. And the cool thing was the guy from the Chamber of Commerce said, "Oh, here, you know, you've got. We've got you free rooms at the Patrick Henry Inn," which was a pretty nice place at the time, you know, and then they said, and the next day, here's some passes to Busch Gardens, you know, it's like an amusement park kind of thing, theme park. And it's based around beer. But the only problem was only one of us was old enough. Mike was the only guy old enough to drink beer.
Oh, really?
But still, we went to the park and had a good time. But the 76 trip got a lot of newspaper attention. 84 trip got some newspaper attention, and that was the first time we got national publicity because we were in USA Today. I don't know how they found us, but they did a couple articles. 2003, a lot of online articles, some newspaper stuff. And then the next trip, 2013, we did that trip, for Alzheimer's, because my dad had Alzheimer's and passed away from it. And that was a really cool trip for a couple of reasons. We had my son, who was 21 at the time. He was on the team. And then we had two young women on the team, Melanie Castro. I'm drawing a blank on Colleen Pellick was on the trip. So it was the first time women had been involved. But as I look back on that trip, we had too many people. We had 5 skaters. We had a photographer. And then we had my wife. So there was 7 people in the van. It was very expensive to do. So we had to raise a lot of money. And we did it for the Alzheimer's Association. Yeah. And that, you know, it got some press, not a ton, but we, you know, we really weren't doing it for the press. I mean, any little bit help. But the amazing thing on that trip is, and this is not an exaggeration, every person that we met on that trip and heard what we were doing and we were talking to them, they either had somebody in their family or had a fan or knew of somebody that had Alzheimer's. It boggled our mind how widespread. And I remember reading an article when I got home that 1 out of 3 people currently have been affected by Alzheimer's in some way. And within 20 years, it was going to be 2 out of 3 people.
Really?
Somebody in their family, themselves, a friend. Yeah.
Well, so, it's beautiful that you did the other skate for Lowe's and mm-hmm. that one to draw the attention, because, you know, the money helps, but I feel like the attention is really what drives it. It's like more people understand it, and it has, you know, the legs to grow and kind of get in more people's heads to understand it. And, you know.
Yep. So real quick, I'll just grab the board that we used in 2003.
Yeah. I like that one. So what's that, like 86 millimeter on there? What do you got? 100 millimeter?
Those are, I think those are 85.
85,
85 orangutans. The board, I'm good. I've been good friends with the guys that loaded forever, and they built that board. It has a maple fiberglass core and then a carbon fiber bottom. But the interesting part is they put a cork top layer on it, which really helped to dampen the vibration, and probably the most comfortable of any of the boards I rode across the country. And that was
so
2013.
Did you run into the same problem I did where, and especially with a board like that, when you're going downhill with those kind of big wheels, you're getting a lot of speed pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so would you have to drag your foot? You couldn't power slide really with that. No. Like, because you're going to kill your wheels, you're going to, you know.
And you don't have, and people, you know, especially on that board, you know, we talked about when we were skating down mountains, like sometimes there were times where I walked because I'm not the downhiller I used to be. I did that trip when I was 56 years old. And
that is exhaust. Like dragging your foot down a long hill is, that beat me up.
And it eats up your shoes, beats you up. And we had guys like online, well, why don't you just throw a slide? I'm like, well, because there was a semi going but next to me at 65 miles an hour. Yeah. I didn't have room. And you're going to, like you said, it's going to ruin your wheels. But
bunch of reasons why you just like, it's a nice idea, but it doesn't, it's not smart.
Exactly. So, you know, we got vibed out, you know, on some of the online forums, because like I said, there were times where we'd walk down a hill. And my kind of thing was, you know, as long as we're skating up it, that's more important, because it's anybody can skate down a hill.
Yeah.
Not anybody can, everybody can skate up a hill or skate up a mountain.
It was an interesting thing, like doing the trip and hearing everyone's opinions the whole time. Mm-hmm. And you just start to realize, like, they almost became immune to them. Like, they just started, half these people, not even half, like 95% have never even done a long distance skate before.
Right. Yeah.
And you know what I mean? So you take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
But it was definitely a learning experience. Like, someone's going to say something and everyone thinks it should be the way they want it to be. And at the end of the day, it's like, it's your experience, you know?
Yeah. And you're right. So many people have never pushed, most people never pushed more than 2 miles or whatever, you know? And it's, you don't realize how long even a mile is, you know, am I done yet kind of thing?
That's actually, people, when they met up with me on the trip, mm-hmm. they would push a mile and or two, and they'd be like completely, you'd see on the video sometimes like gassed and like, I'm done. I don't know how you're doing this.
In 2003, we were going through Nebraska, And we went through this little town, and these kids saw us skating. And so one of the kids, a group of the kids came out on their, you know, regular boards, hard wheels, and were pushing along. And I was really amazed. I mean, they pushed with us, with one of the guys, for like 2 or 3 miles. And they were just, I mean, they were dying, but they wanted to do it. And then all of a sudden they realized, oh, crap, I got to get back. You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah, but yeah. I had one guy. I think he did like 5 or 10 with me and then skated back. But he had, he'd done like a couple of long distance pushes before, but still, right. That was like pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So the board from, I think it's 76, that one's in the Smithsonian, right?
That one's in the Smithsonian, which is, if you would have told me when I was 17 years old, 18 years old, that something of mine would be in the Smithsonian, I'd said, you're out of your mind. And so they have that board. I had 3 electric boards that I used on the trip. They have one of those. They have my son's board from the 2013 trip. And I've got this great photo of my son. We're in the archives of the Smithsonian, and he's getting ready to give him his board, but he's standing on it, and he's got this look on his face like, maybe I don't want to give it to you. I'm like, no, you're giving it to them. And the funny thing, when you give the Smithsonian something, you have to sign a deed. You have to deed it over to them. And it doesn't come back. You know, it's theirs forever. And in fact, when we went there after the 2013 trip to give them some stuff from that trip, they had already had my board from 76. And so the woman, we're in the archives, and she says, you want to see your board? I'm like, yeah. And so she opens up this cabinet, and she has white gloves on. And first of all, my board is, you'll get a kick out of this. My board is laying right next to Tony Hawk's first skateboard that his brother gave him, a Bane from the 70s.
Wow.
And I said, Tony's in good company, you know? So she picks up the board and she's, you know, starts to hand it to me, and I start to grab it. And then she pulls it back and she says, no, you got to put gloves on. She says, this is no longer a skateboard. It's an archive or something.
Yeah. You artifact know. Or yeah.
So I had to put on white gloves to hold my own skateboard, but it's, you know, it's a kick that it's there and that it's always going to, you know, it'll always be there.
Yeah. No, it's incredible. So, when did that happen? Was that quickly afterwards? Was that years later?
No, it didn't happen until I'm guessing early 2000s, maybe a little bit later. Yeah, maybe 2006, 2007, somewhere along there. And I don't even remember how it happened, but they got in touch with me and I sent it to them. And I was very lucky because at one point in my life when I needed money, I'd actually sold that board and sold it to one of the owners. You're probably familiar with the company CCS.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So they were started in the town near me in San Luis Obispo. That's where the roots of that company are. And I sold it to the owner. And then when CCS sold, he had a pretty big collection. And he's like, hey, Jack, why don't you come pick up your board? And so he gave it back to me. So that was
just gave it back to you. That's it. Yeah, didn't ask for anything.
No, Jim Hall. Just
that's very, really cool.
Very cool of him to do that. So,
wow. Yeah. That's funny. Your last trip, you just did one recently too, right?
Well, we did the electric one. Like I said, we finished that one up and we did that and finished that one in 2018. And then I did a trip this summer. You know, I've been working on this script, kind of a fictionalized script about my first trip, because that's a trip that I, you know, think was to me was the most important. And I was working on a script and, you know, I started thinking about, you know, long distance skating is now like a sport. I mean, these guys train for it. I mean, there's guys who've skated 300 miles in a single day on a race.
Yeah, the Ultra down in Florida, right?
Yeah, it blows my mind.
I started researching,
Yeah. So, and I know some of those guys, and I started thinking, what if I put together a team of guys, 4 guys, how fast could they do it? And I just kept daydreaming about it. Finally, one day I said, screw it. And I wrote 4 guys an email, Paul Kent, Miles Kipper, Rick Stubblefield, and Andy Andras, who was one of the guys who skated over 300 miles in a single day.
Yeah. I've heard of him. Yeah.
And I said, what do you guys think? You want to do this? I said, use the same route kind of as I did, but maybe go east to west. And, you know, I didn't know what they were going to say. And right away, all of them said, yeah, let's do it. So my son and I, we put together, you know, a little bit of sponsorship, but it was really kind of a whole self-funded thing. And my son and I decided we would be their support crew. Flew out to Williamsburg and met up with the team. And these guys are freaking animals. They did it in 17 days and 6 hours. Skated every inch of the way. The first 2 to 3 days going through the Appalachians, it was raining all day long, and they're skating in the rain. And it was just,
yeah, you know,
the fastest we had ever done it was 21 days in 2003. But I mean, these guys were just, I mean, they're athletes. We were, I always tell
people, they're training, right? They're doing like, they've done long 200, 300 mile days.
And they're skating every day. You know, and I always tell people the difference is we were just a bunch of knuckleheads who wanted to do something fun. These guys are athletes, you know?
You know, something people don't really consider too is you could skate 100 miles or 50 miles locally, maybe, you know, a couple people. But when you start like going across the country, not on a path or perfect ground or something, and there's hills and mountains and cars, traffic lights, you realize how quickly your time goes down. And you know.
And that happened on this thing this summer where the guys that were involved in this, Paul Kent has done a lot of what I call open road skating, but the other three guys were mainly, you know, bike path, close course skaters. And they thought, oh yeah, no problem. You know, as a relay, we'll be doing, you know, 250 miles a day.
Yeah.
And I'm like, guys, you won't, you know, I said, it's just
a little different.
A little different. I said, you're not on a closed course. And I think it was after 2 days in, Andy came to me and says, okay, I get it. You know, I understand now that we're not going to hit that, because they thought they were going to do it in 14 days, but
yes,
it's everything. I mean, road surface, weather, traffic, you know, it's a whole lot different when you're out, I call open road skating.
Much different. But, so of all the trips, you know, you've done it with three people, like five people, like different groups. Mm-hmm. What was the solo one? Well, it wasn't fully solo, but you were out there kind of by yourself, right? For a lot of the time.
The electric.
What was that like, that difference in experience, you know?
As we touched on a little bit earlier, just being on the side of the road for that many hours of the day, trying to be aware of traffic. And then you just, you know, even as you're being aware of the traffic, though, you're just out there by yourself. You have a lot of time to think, you know, and being older, you know, 61, you know, I was reflecting on what I had done before, the different trips. And one thing I thought a lot about on that trip was, this is probably it. It's probably the last one I'm going to do. Powered or unpowered, you know?
Yeah.
And it, you know, it probably is. So just tons of time for introspection. And then the thing I always tell people about skating cross country, when you're in a car and you're driving cross country, you can go through three or four different environments in a day. When you're on a skateboard, you're in that same environment for 3 or 4 days. And so you really get to see everything up close and personal. You get to smell everything up close and personal. And you're just much more aware of your surroundings. And then you have the opportunity to interact with people because you're not in a vehicle.
Yeah, that's well put. And when people would ask me about it, I would say, you're passing by all these moments in the car and inside of everything. Like if you shrink it down, there's like, you know, on each level, it gets more, I don't know what the word is, like intimate, you know what I mean? And
perfect word.
Yeah. And in the car, you just, you know, oh, maybe a cow or something, you know, but when you're passing by it and you're staring it in the face and, you know, just nothing around, it's a different experience.
Well, you and I talked about when you're doing your trip about animals, about talking to the cows and then causing stampedes because something freaked them out about skateboarding. A bicyclist can go by, no big deal. You're on a skateboard, horses, cows freak out.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the sound or the vibration or whatever it is, but they lock in. Yeah.
So, you know, and then, so that was my, you know, that was the last one. And it was pretty emotional at the end. My, we got to Arlington, Virginia, and that was our, you know, the second to the last day, because the next day was only a few miles to get to the Smithsonian. And, you know, when we finished that day, it was just me and my wife there in a park, and it was really emotional, you know, because we both realized, you know, that it was this really fun, great journey. But probably the last time that I was going to do a cross-country trip on a skateboard of any type.
Right.
So then I switched my focus the last few years to doing trips in this crazy 1964 electrified Volkswagen. Last summer, I retraced the path of, of the first guy to drive a car across America in 1903. A buddy and I followed that to, from San Francisco to New York City. It took us 3 weeks. And then we turned around, another buddy joined, and we drove back to San Francisco on what was the 1913 version of the Lincoln Highway. And then this summer, my wife and I just actually in October, my wife and I just got back from driving the same van, electric Volkswagen converted on Route 66 from Chicago to Santa Monica. And this has, it has, it's funny because this has a skateboard connection. The fellow who owns EV West is a guy named Michael Bream. He used to own Gravity Skateboards and then got into the electric vehicle world. And he just loans me this thing. And I was like, when I came up with the idea last year, he's like, oh, here, take this. And then I came up with the idea for this year. And it's like, yeah, take it again. And in fact, even he even shipped it to Chicago for us. And then we flew to Chicago and picked it up and drove it back. And so now I'm thinking, I got back, okay, what do I want to do next? Because I think, you know, the older I get, I think, well, if I keep doing stuff, I'm not going to get old. And
hey, you don't use it, you lose it.
Exactly. So I started looking around and I found out that there was actually a guy on a motorcycle in 1903 that finished 20 days before the guy in the first guy to drive a car across country. But everybody forgot about him as soon as the guy in the car did it, because nobody cared about motorcycles. So I'm not a motorcycle guy. I've never really ridden motorcycles. So my plan is next May, I'm going to retrace the guy's route on the motorcycle, but I'm going to do it on an electric bicycle that looks like an old time motorcycle. So hopefully
that's
that'll
awesome.
Work out. Yeah.
I really like the idea. That's cool.
I'm going to do it solo. So it'll be interesting.
Completely solo.
So no support crew.
Wow,
I'm taking lessons from you. I'm going to take one set of clothes, you know, a charger, my phone.
Yeah, going light's the way to go, I think, if you're going by yourself, because, you know, that support vehicle, keeping that weight, you don't realize it.
Yeah.
But it really, you know, it helps to be light. But that's incredible that you're going to do that. Where can everyone follow that?
Well, I'll eventually post it up on my Facebook and Instagram pages. And then we'll probably create a special Instagram page for it. I haven't come up with a name for it yet. Because we're still in the planning process.
I'm ready to follow. That's right. Awesome.
Cool.
Oh, yeah. Well, Jack, thanks for sitting down, talking with me, telling your stories. I appreciate it.
Oh, man. Thanks for having me. It's just, you know, and it's weird because I feel like I know you because, you know, we talked a bit on your trip and, you know, I'm your fanboy, man, because you did what I always wanted to do, you know?
Hey, man, it was cool along my trip. It's getting messages from you, you know? I'm like, all right, I'm doing something right. The guy who invented it is giving me compliments, so that's awesome.
Thanks. All right.
Oh, yeah. All right, good talking to you.
Okay. All right.
All right, bye-bye. Take care. Bye.